Welcome to Section 9. My name's Damian Hull.
And I'm Dorothy. In this week's episode, we're going to be talking about installing Kali Linux on a Raspberry Pi, the process that we went through, the challenges that we encounter, and definitely the lessons that we have learned. When I decided to embark on this project, I chose a book called Penetration Testing with Raspberry Pi. And one of the things that Damian always likes to tell me is, read ahead. So what I did is I read chapter one to kind of prepare myself and see what was going on and what I was going to be doing. And in reading the chapter, I thought, wow, there is a lot that I have to do on this chapter. So I'm going to go ahead and choose a small part of it, you know, break it into bite-sized pieces and do this part of it. So I chose to put the Raspberry Pi together, make a backup of the SD card, and installing Kali Linux in it. And I thought this will save time as well as simplify the process. And, you know, when I looked at the hardware part of the book, that was actually pretty good. They chose a really good kit. I didn't have to worry about, oh my gosh, you know, I need to be looking at, you know, buying this, buying that. The starter kit that they chose was really, really good. And one of the things that I've learned was they said, make sure that you have an SD card class 10, because the Raspberry Pi 3, the Model B that they're using, it's a 64-bit and it's quad-core. So they needed to make sure that you have a card that was fast enough to not slow the Pi down. And, you know, that's a Class 10 SD card. So I didn't know that, so I learned that. Another thing that they pointed out is, for example, on the Raspberry Pi 2, the SD card is spring-loaded, but not on the 3. On the 3, if you're looking for that fuzzy feeling to where you spring load your card in there, it's not going to happen. So they said, be really careful when you put it in and don't push really hard, you know, waiting for that spring loaded feeling because it's not spring loaded. And apparently they told the Raspberry Pi people that because there were kind of a lot of people were upset about that whole thing. What did you think of the hardware part of it?
Well, anytime you talk about purchasing hardware, it's always a challenge because it's hard to figure out what you need for a given project. And we've had our own projects here where we didn't have very good instructions and we chose to kind of go it alone and do our own thing. And what happened? We purchased the wrong hardware. So while some of it may have been fine, we tried to add in another piece. And I talk about this in the past where we needed storage for one of our smaller computers and I purchased the wrong storage for that device. So it's nice when you have a kit. And do you remember which kit you bought?
Yeah, it was the Kanakit starter kit. It was the 32-gigabyte one.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that included, you know, everything you needed, the power supply, the SD card, the case, and putting the Raspberry Pi in the case was relatively simple. We watched a video on that, but, you know, you don't really necessarily have to watch the video. It's pretty straightforward.
Well, and just to tell people why you had me watch the video, I am learning on this. I'm more of a noob than Damian is. So he's trying to get me into the habit of watch the video before you do this or, you know, look online for instructions if things are not clear. So I did watch the video and, you know.
Yeah. And that's something that's really important to understand here is that anytime you do something in IT, you want to do your homework ahead of time. Even if it is something you think you know something about, do your homework anyway. And this was something I'd never seen before. So I wanted to see what the process is before we started to make sure that we didn't do something that might damage the hardware. Because once you damage hardware, that's it. You got to get a new one. But overall, I thought that process was relatively straightforward and they did a good job of recommending the right hardware.
No, they did. It wasn't until I got into the software part of it that things started falling apart fast. I got humbled right off the bat. I mean, we had issues with the book in the respect that sometimes the sentences didn't make sense. And I'm glad I had you because you read the sentence and you said, yeah, that doesn't make any sense. Another example of what I had a hard time with the instructions in the book was for some of the things that we had to do, they would give you can do it on Windows, you can do it on Mac, and you can do it on Linux. And they would have the commands for Windows and they would have the commands for Mac, but nothing on Linux. And I am a real beginner of Linux. I know a little bit of Linux, but not enough to really hurt anybody or myself. And the first thing that I tried was backing up the SD card using the Linux commands that were in the book. And I run into all sorts of troubles and things that I really didn't understand. So would you mind explaining that to everybody? Because I don't think I can.
So the book would talk about, you know, like you said, Mac and Linux examples. And then you go look at the example, and it's not a Linux example, it's a Mac example. And one of the things that you don't know about the Mac is that we have Unix-like operating systems, which Linux is kind of loosely based on Unix. It has some Unix commands in there, but not all Unix commands are the same. So for example, when you talk about the Mac is going to have some commands in there, say like cd for change directory, ls for listing the directory. Those are typical commands you're going to find on all Unix-like operating systems. But then they talked about the disk utility command, which we don't have in Linux. That's only on the Mac. You can't use that. And then there may be some things that are more specific to Linux that you want to have access to. So they'll talk about things like DD, which you're going to use to back up the SD card onto your Linux laptop. But then when they talk about finding the SD card and unmounting the SD card, because they mention unmounting, but they don't show you how to do that.
Yeah, and I don't really know what that is. I mean, I know things have to be mounted, but I really don't know how to do that. I never had to. So
in this case, what you're going to be doing is you're going to use DD, which is the command you're going to use to copy the bits. And DD is used to copy all the bits off of a drive and put them somewhere. So that's a good way of sort of imaging your SD card in this case. That's really what they want you to do. And you're going to have a backup of the original software on that. So if you need to go back to that or you want to see what's on there, you can put that back on the SD card, put it back in the Raspberry Pi, and see what the default configuration is and what that noob software is all about.
Right.
So the issue I had with the way the instructions were written is that they talk about, again, unmounting the SD card. Why do we do that? Because as soon as you put it in, it gets mounted and you can see what kinds of things they have on that SD card, what files are there. The reason why they want you to unmount the SD card is because there's a file system on there and they don't want the file system to get damaged in the process of backing it up. So you have to unmount it. Now, how do you figure out where the thing is mounted? So we use things like fdisk-l to list all of the drives you have on the system. And we did that first because we want to see, okay, what do you have on this particular laptop of yours? And we should point out you're using your Linux laptop. And so we do fdisk-l, and it shows you the drives you have on your system. Then we put in the SD card, we do fdisk-l, and we see that this is another drive letter on that particular system. And now we have to figure out how to unmount the file system from your Linux laptop so that when we use DD, we don't damage the file system. So that became an issue because I couldn't remember how to do that. And I think in older versions of Linux, you could actually just list the thing and it would actually show you in the proper directory where something might be mounted. And in this case, it doesn't do that anymore. So we had to do some searching and figured out you can use the mount command. If you just type in mount on Linux, you can see where things are mounted. So we figured out where that location was, and then we used the unmount command to unmount that.
It was umount, right?
Yeah, umount is the actual command you type in, and it's short for unmount.
Right. But I would have not. Okay, picture a noob like me not knowing enough about Linux. And like I said, I was so super excited when I picked this project thinking, wow, it's basic. They're going to give me the commands for Linux for me to understand how to do that. And I'm going to learn that. And the one thing that didn't have in there were the Linux commands when it came to this thing.
So this is what I would say about the book. They didn't edit it. That was obvious because there were some sentences, like you said, that were just obviously not written well. And you would read that and it's like, yeah, that makes no sense at all. And you kind of sort of could pull some information out of the sentence, but it wasn't clear. And the other thing that they didn't include in there are the necessary steps for certain things. So they would go up to a point and then it would stop and then they would go on to something else. And it's like, well, where's the rest of it? And part of that was the fact that they didn't have all of the Linux commands necessary to proceed on your Linux laptop. And then why not have the commands for Linux to unmount something? Why not talk about those kinds of things? Give us some idea of how that process works.
And you know, you and I have talked about, you know, books sometimes assuming that you may know something. So I have to wonder if they just kind of assumed that you knew a certain amount of Linux, you know, or maybe it was like a total oversight. So for me, I don't really know what to think of the whole thing, because to me, when you're saying to me, this is a basics book, I'm thinking at least basics command, how to mount something or unmount it should be a part of it. But I don't know if they were assuming that you knew enough Linux.
I don't know if I can, you know, because I haven't read the book.
Because some of the things in the book were good. I mean, you know.
Yeah, but I haven't read the book, so I can't say too much about it. But the parts that we went over to try to figure out how to accomplish a task, they were, some of it was okay, but overall, I thought the book was lacking. And I think I would give it almost an F, because if you didn't have me there to help you with some of that, you couldn't use the book. So I think for those who want to try and do this themselves, unless you have a background in Linux, you may want to stick with a Windows system to try to do this, you know, set up your SD card on Windows or maybe even a Mac, because that those set of instructions were okay. They weren't great, but they were okay. And so if you do this on Linux, you're going to have to do a lot of research or find somebody to help you.
Yeah. And my whole purpose for getting into this project also was to learn a little bit more about Linux. So, I probably could have done it on Windows, but I really wanted to do it on Linux. And it was really disappointing and disheartening for me that, thank God I have you. But for those of you out there that are beginners like me and you're trying to work on a project that you get excited about and you run into this, please don't drop it. Do the research. You know, look at some of the things that are out there. And one of the things I really liked about having Damien tell me and show me how to do things, because he didn't have the luxury of having the videos back then. He didn't have the luxury of having GUI back then when he was trying to do this on himself, you know, on his own, is that learning that research is really going to help for you to be more self-sufficient about IT. And I know it takes a long time, but I just want to kind of encourage people because I think it's valuable.
No, and that's something that's really important to mention here, is that as you go through these projects, as you realize, hey, my book is not giving me everything that I need. And this is something that we've talked about in the past. A book is not enough. A video is not enough. A website's not enough. So you have to incorporate book, video, websites, maybe a friend who knows something about this. You know, you have to have multiple things that you're going to have access to in order to find the right information to accomplish your task.
And one of the things you always tell me, find someone else that wants to do the same project as you, and maybe between the two of you, you can kind of get it done. And I was grateful that you actually wanted to kind of be a backup in the background to see what kind of help I needed, because I really did wanted to do this by myself, but it's obvious that I just couldn't do it between my gaps in my IT skills and in this. So another thing that we ran into was when we tried to install Kali Linux, from the downloading and installing of Kali Linux on the SD card to the resizing the partition and doing the updates. Why don't you fill them in on what the issues that we got? Goodness, it was.
So there was a little bit of an issue in figuring out which version of Kali Linux we were supposed to download. And the book did say, here's the website you go to. So we went there. It had the version of Kali Linux that we needed.
It just says, choose the one that works for this. It didn't give you a specific
one. Right. So you have to have the ARM version, because that's what the Kali Linux or the Raspberry Pi uses as a processor. So that was listed there. And it actually says something about the Raspberry Pi. But there were several different options you had to choose from. So for somebody who's new to this, it may be a little confusing. Which one do I pick? So we went ahead and got the one that was for the Raspberry Pi, and it said Pi 2 and 3. So that's the one we downloaded. And I don't know what the other versions are for, but they're listed there. There was like three or four options you could choose from.
Another thing, though, that they recommended was to check the SHA, some on that. And the book said it was SHA 1. But when you looked at the version that we picked, it wasn't that, was it? It was the SHA 256. And then I would have not known that would have made a difference, because I never had to check the SHA on anything to make sure that something wasn't intact.
And then when they recommended you do that, they didn't make the process clear, because they wanted you to download these different files. And when we went to go look at that, either we were in the wrong place or they didn't have those files, or something was a bit different on the website than it was in the book. And so we had to figure out how to use the SHA some command, because it's not something that I use a lot. You know, in fact, I almost never use it. In the past, when I was learning how to use Linux, they would say, okay, use the MD5 some command. And they had, you know, I learned how to do that years and years ago, but I had forgotten how that process worked. So we happened to find, and this goes into the research part of it, a website that had the necessary commands for us to use that SHA-256 SUM command. And then you were able to compare that to the Kali Linux download, and it actually worked out.
Right. But, you know, one of the things that disappointed me on all of the stuff, because we were both doing research on that, I read something on one of the blogs that I was looking at, and this guy was like, yeah, you know, you could do that. You could check the SHA, but, you know, you don't have to. And I'm thinking, why wouldn't you? Especially in security, wouldn't you want to know that something was not, you know, somebody didn't add something or took something away?
Well, that brings up a good point. So in the past, the reason why you would check your hash values, and the reason, here's what happens. You have a hash value on the website, then you download the software and you double check it against the hash that's there. And the reason why you do that, at least in the past, is you wanted to make sure that your download wasn't corrupted. So what the SHA does is it checks the bits. Did I get all of the bits? Do they match? But you bring up another issue here. If the bits don't match, then maybe either you have a corrupted version of the software, or as you point out, maybe something's been modified. And that's something that you have to be aware of in security. There will be cases where you don't want to use, and I had this in my SANS training, the instructor said, you may want to have specific tools on a USB drive that you bring with you. And then when you go to do your forensics or your checking of the system, use the tools that you have on your USB drive, because the ones on the system may have been modified by the hacker and they may not work the way you expect them to.
Well, that makes sense.
So that kind of is a roundabout story about how you need to make sure you have the right tools, not ones that have been modified by somebody else. But I think in this case, what they're really looking for when you use that SHA-SUM tool,
right, is to make sure you got the whole thing.
Is to make sure you got all of the bits necessary.
But again, I mean, to me, when I do the research, should I not have someone in my life, you know, my IT life, like you, that you go, okay, security, this is important in security. This is important in security. What if I don't know what is important in security and I run into this guy on a blog that goes, nah, that's not necessary. You know, there is a bad habit, you know, and for me, it's frustrating. That's why I don't like blogs. I really rather go to a book, a video, a website, but not some, and I know that you find them very useful.
Well, but take a look at what happened with your book. You know, the book is not helping you with certain steps. It's not clear what to do. So, you know, sometimes the websites, especially if you go to the websites for a particular product or software that you're using, sometimes they'll have a section in there that has the necessary steps or process to do what you're looking for.
And I understand that. I'm not, you know, I'm not bashing on blogs. I'm just thinking that, you know, it's kind of like buying a bunch of books or watching a bunch of videos that you think they're going to show you something, and then they fall short or they don't have something in there. We do the research takes so long in IT, and having to waste my time with a guy that goes, yeah, that's not important. That kind of frustrates me, to be honest with you.
No, and that goes back to this whole idea of having multiple things to access. So you have your book, you have your video, you have your different websites you go to. All of that is going to help you figure out what you're supposed to do, because even if a book is written really well, it may be missing a bunch of stuff anyway because they just couldn't fit it in.
Okay. And then the other thing we had an issue with, and you just to get back to on point, was resizing the partition.
That was a little goofy. I think that they had some of the right commands in the book, but they talked about things like cylinders, heads, and sectors. And what you're trying to do here when you resize a partition, so we should explain what that is. The partition is the boundary for your file system. It says, okay, here's the beginning of the partition, here's the ending of a partition. Inside of that is the amount of space you have for a given file system, and that's it.
Well, and one of the things is that the reason why they had us do that is so we would be able to use the whole 32 gigabit bytes on the SD card, because it was only showing us 6, right?
Right. So when you download Kali Linux from the website and you copy that using DD onto the SD card, it's too small. It doesn't use the entire 32 gigabytes of the actual SD card. So what they want you to do is resize a partition. In order to do that, you have to know the starting point and the ending point of that second partition. They have two partitions. You want to do it on the second partition. And the reason why they have it in cylinders, heads, and sectors is because they want you to get the correct number for the starting point and the end point of that partition.
And actually, the book was kind of decent when it came to those instructions, semi-sort of, right? Because, I mean, you did have to help me because I didn't really understand, you know, partition one, partition two, and all
and
of that.
And in this case, we should also point out that you already have Kali Linux installed on the SD card. You have already put it into the Raspberry Pi. You've already turned the system on. You've already logged in. So these are commands that are on the actual Kali Linux installation on the Raspberry Pi. So they have to give you the Kali Linux commands. They can't give you Mac commands or somebody else's commands. It has to match what's on Kali Linux. And so I thought they did an okay job with that. The hard part, even for me, is that I don't spend a lot of time looking at cylinders, heads, and sectors and partitions and all of that. So even for me, I was like, okay, let's double check and make sure we're in the right place, doing the right thing, so we don't damage this and have to start all over again.
Right. And I think the worst part for me was the updates. So I'm trying to do update, you know, the command for updates. And the funniest thing is like, nothing's happening. I keep getting this error message. And Debian says to me, check to see if you have internet, right? So I go, ifconfig. The command doesn't exist. And I was like, what do I do now? So,
yeah, so that was odd. And we still don't know what the command is to list all of the network interfaces you have on Kali Linux. Now, what's interesting, though, is that if you do a regular install of Kali Linux, mm-hmm. ifconfig is there.
Right. So but this is an ARM version.
So this is on the ARM version. It's a smaller version of Kali Linux. They made some modifications to it so it works with the Raspberry Pi. Why did they take out ifconfig? I have no idea. It makes no sense to me at all as to why they would do something like that.
Yeah. So, so we continue?
Yeah. So what ended up happening is that we kind of tried to compare what you see in Kali Linux with other Linux distributions and desktops that they have in there. So I should point out that, you know, I recognized the desktop they have here on your version of Kali Linux on the Raspberry Pi. It's something called XFCE, and it's a lightweight Linux desktop. Works really well. I kind of like it. Up in the top right-hand corner on your Ubuntu laptop, you have the network icon in there, and you can click on that, and you can select your wireless interface, your Ethernet. You can make modifications to the network configuration there. So I said, okay, let's check that. Let's see if we can go in the top right-hand corner and click there and see what we get. See if there's a drop-down for the network configuration. And sure enough, there is. There's a Wi-Fi setting. There's, you know, other stuff in there. And so we were able to do that. But one of the things that I was kind of sitting there and watching you try to struggle with this whole thing, I was waiting for you to say, okay, do I have network connectivity?
Right. And I didn't.
And so this is where I think projects like this really help, is that when you're forced into a situation where you have to do the thinking for yourself, I think that that's a good thing because that helps you understand that there are things you have to remember in all of your projects to proceed to a next step.
And this is where the checklist is really important. You know, and this is what I kind of was hoping to learn, how to make my checklist. One of the things that I always should check for is, do I have internet connectivity? Because I was so caught up on all the problems we were having with the software part of it, that internet access, really seriously, and that should have been the first thing that I should have thought when the updates were failing, you know, and I was getting that error message. My first thought should have been, do I have internet access for these updates to come? So, you know, it was a humbling experience, to say the least. So, you know, for me, lessons learned, this was hard for me. I got super excited thinking, you know, I've been doing all this hard work, putting the network together, getting my networking skills to start my first project, and realize I don't know enough. I really don't know enough about this. And you know, thinking that I mean, getting one of the biggest challenges at the very first part of the project is a very humbling experience. I never in a million years thought that the biggest thing that I was going to face, the biggest challenge, was going to be at the very beginning of my project with the software. You know, with realizing, I don't know enough Linux. What was I thinking? Granted, my mistake and my part in it. You know, when I look at, whenever I fail at something, I always like to say, okay, what's my part in it? And my part in it is, I assumed that book was going to have a blow-by-blow Linux command so I could learn it because that's what I wanted. I didn't realize that I really don't know enough to be sitting in there and doing a project like this on my own. And thank God that I have you to help me, because, and what Damien has been really good at is he won't tell me what to do, but he would steer me in the right direction. You need to research that. Where do you start the research? Watch the video, look at the website, you know, what's going on in here. And the one thing where you were like, there was something he just got really quiet and wasn't telling me, it was when he wanted me to realize you don't have internet connection, you're not checking for that, and that should be a basic, you should know that. So, you know, it was a combination of, oh my goodness, I didn't plan it as well as I thought I did, I didn't know enough, and, you know, step one, I'm not giving up in the book. I'm going to see it through. I'm going to look at the whole project. And, you know, I'm going to try to learn along the way how to research and how to try to find out, you know, where the holes are at. And granted, that was my whole purpose for this project. Where are my holes? Where are my skills? And again, I never dreamt in a million years that it was going to be staring me in the face on the very first part of chapter one. But hey, lesson learned for me.
You know, one of the things that I should point out here is that a lot of people in IT go into one section. You know, they'll be Windows Server administrators. They will be network engineers. They will be Linux administrators. You know, they may have some understanding of what goes on in the other disciplines. You know, if you're a Linux admin, you might know something about the network side because you have to get your system connected to the network. So you can understand things like your IP address, your network interface cards, maybe some Wi-Fi, maybe what a default gateway is. So you understand some of these basic things about the network. But there are a lot of system administrators who don't understand how the network functions. Somebody else has to put the networking piece together for them. If you're a network engineer, you may not understand how servers are put together. How do I put Server 2012 together as a domain controller? How do I install Linux as a web server or as a file server? Or how do I do security with something like Kali Linux? You know, network engineers don't do those kinds of things. While network engineering may be a part of security, network engineers don't do that kind of thing. You know, they're not, you know, they may not understand some of the tools that are used for security or some of the security best practices for making things like Windows more secure. So it's kind of broken up into different sections, and most of the time people will stick to their area of expertise. If I'm a network engineer, I'm going to stay in network engineering. The issue that we have is that we want to go into security. What does that mean? You need to know a little bit about all of that. And that's the big issue we have, is that you're not just doing network engineering, you're doing Linux, Windows. You have to know industry best practices for keeping the network secure. You're also looking at network equipment. So there's a lot of things you have to do. So it can be overwhelming, and there's just so much to learn that there's always going to be a situation you're in where you realize, hey, I don't know enough about this particular thing. Like in this case, Linux.
Well, and one of the things that sticks with me, because you told me this story when you were doing your master's degree, and a part of the reason why we started the podcast, because you always say to me, if you can't explain it, then you don't understand it. You need to really be able to explain the process. And if you're able to explain the process, then you're going to know what the process is. If you can't explain it, there are things that are missing and you're not understanding, and you need to go back to step one and try to understand it. What's on that paper that you were doing about trying to explain a certain process, and the lady said something to you about, oh, but you're missing this. Do you want to share that story?
Yeah, so we had to write a paper about upgrading an existing network. And the network had something called FinNet, which we don't use anymore. And this was old networking technology where you used coax cable to connect all of your computers together. So I had a process for upgrading the network to a star topology, and we're going to use Cat 5, and it's going to be awesome, and all of these things are going to be part of the process. And I wrote my paper, submitted it, and then this is what she said. You have some good things in here, but what about your network card? There's no, you know, you went from coax to Cat 5, and you didn't change your network card. Because the network card that's in the system to begin with is for coax. It's not for Cat 5. So in that case, that would have been a big failure if I had done that in the real world, because there would be no way for you to plug in your Cat 5 cable once you get to that point. So she brought up something that I thought was really good, in that you have to make sure that when you look at all of the things that we do in IT, all the steps you take for a particular project, like your Raspberry Pi project, that you include all the necessary steps involved. And that's where I think the book is kind of sort of
missing,
you know, missing these things where, okay, I want to unmount or copy the operating system off of the SD card and save it as a backup image. It's saying, okay, do that with DD. Here's a DD command. But where's the rest of it?
Yeah, and you're on your own, basically. That's how it felt.
You're on your own. And that's not, I understand why sometimes books have to do that. But in this case, I think they're just missing so many different things in there. I think they didn't edit properly. And I think they're just leaving stuff out they should have included.
Well, and like I said, I'd like to give the book a little bit more of a benefit of the doubt and continue to do that to see if it's a consistent thing that happens. And I guess what I'm going to do is reap the benefit by, if that is what they continue to do, then I will be practicing my research skills and try to figure out how to do things. But I think doing my checklist with my basics, no matter what project I do, checking that I have internet access is going to be one of the things on my checklist, you know. So I've learned a lot. Did you learn anything from watching the project at all, or was it just kind of easier for you?
No, I think this was good for me because I got to see how the process works, and I got to see that, okay, the Raspberry Pi can run Kali Linux, and here's how you do that. So for me, that was kind of a good thing to see because I had no idea how to do that. And then seeing how the book was kind of missing a few things, I thought, okay, yeah, a lot of books do that. And that reminded me of the process I had to go through when I would read a book and it would be missing a few things. Because that's how I learned how to do this stuff. There was nobody there to help me. I wanted to learn all these different things about the internet, about email, about Linux. And so I just had to, you know, jump in and do the project and figure out how to make an email server and ask questions of people and do all kinds of searching. And simple projects would take me weeks to finish because there was just so much research you had to do.
Well, and, you know, when you met me, one of the things you said to me, you just have to jump in and do the projects. And I was terrified because I didn't know what to do with any of the devices and how to put it together, never mind, you know, seeing a project through. And for me, it was big to select a project on my own that I wanted to try on my own and I wanted to do. And I was feeling like, wow, what an epic failure. But looking back on it, I have to realize, look at how much I've learned just from that big, huge challenge and the humbling experience that I got to just the very first part of chapter one. I mean, you know, so.
And this is one of the things we were talking about before where, you know, people who are good at IT are the ones that show up every day because IT requires you to know so many different things. And the only way you're going to do that is by jumping into projects like this, because oftentimes you may not be doing the kinds of things you want to learn, or you may not be in the area of IT you want to be in. So there's nobody there to show you how to do some of these things. And so what do you have to do? You have to find a book. You have to find a website. You have to find a video that gives you a starting point.
Right.
And then you have to jump in and try to do some of the things that you see. And in this case, that's what you're doing. And little by little, you're going to be the one person who took the time to learn how these things work, and that's how you get ahead. That's how you learn more about IT. And those are the people that are going to be really good, because that, you know, the people that I go to that I know as friends who are really good at IT, what do they do in their spare time? More IT. mm-hmm. and they're doing things that maybe they don't get to do at work, or they're trying to learn something they find interesting. And little by little, they add that to the list of skills they have, and they end up doing things they want to do. Like in the case of security, I know somebody who is really good at that. What do they do at home? They do more security stuff. They practice doing the things they enjoy doing at home with IT. So, you know, that's how you do it. That's how you learn these things.
Yeah. It's been a humbling experience.
Yeah. Anything else?
Yeah. You know, what I really want to say is that I have learned not only how much I don't know, but it's given me kind of a little map to where how much I have to learn. So IT is going to be like that. You can't just sit on your laurels. You're just going to have to every day learn a little bit and then, you know, get there.
Yeah. Let's see here. If you want to see our show notes, you can check them out at section9.us. And we will have some information about the hardware and some other things in there. And then if you have any comments or questions, you can email us at info@section9.us.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.